The Guardian.
This is Politics Weekly. I'm Sonia Soda.
You, the public, have had enough. You're tired of the infighting. You're tired of the political games and the arcane procedural rows. Tired of MPs talking about nothing else but Brexit.
Well, it's safe to say no one thought the year 1604 would be trending on Twitter this week. But that was just the start of it. First, John Bercow cited parliamentary precedents dating back to the 17th century to rule that Theresa May couldn't bring the same Brexit deal back to the Commons for a third time. Donald Tusk then upped the ante by announcing that MPs must pass May's Brexit deal next week for the UK to get an Article 50 extension. Theresa May promptly went on live TV and said, "It's not my fault, it's the politicians." And not to be outdone, Jeremy Corbyn flounced out of a cross-party Brexit summit just because Chukwuemeka was there. And it's only Thursday. Also this week, with another march for a people's vote happening this Saturday and record numbers expected to attend, we talk second referendums. That's all in this week's Politics Weekly. But first, what a week. After John Bercow derailed May's plans for meaningful vote 3 this week, government went into meltdown. Hardcore leavers and remainers both rejoiced. Confusion reigned. But then meaningful vote 3 was suddenly back on the cards again. Donald Tusk told May that Britain could only extend Article 50 if MPs vote for the withdrawal agreement in the Commons next week. So with just days to go till Brexit Day, Parliament is all set for a final deal versus no deal clash next week. And all bets are off. I'm joined to discuss all this by Jonathan Friedland and Ellie May O'Hagan from The Guardian and Katie Balls from The Spectator. So, Johnny, if I could start with you. Earlier this week, there was a lot of chat about how we're in a major constitutional crisis after John Bercow made his decision. And now it seems things have got worse. How bad is it right now? Are we in constitutional crisis plus?
Yes, I think we are. Usually that phrase is an exaggeration, but I would say that we are. And not necessarily for the reason you think. Previously, people thought it was because of this standoff between the Speaker and the Executive in the form of the Prime Minister. The thing that makes me think that is the speech that Theresa May gave on Wednesday night, where she adopted a tone which, and it's often hard to see it in her because she doesn't have the charisma that normally comes with a populist politician. We're not used to populist demagogues who don't have charisma, but she's one. And she made a speech that really was a kind of Trumpian speech, which said, "I embody the will of the people, and these elites," meaning MPs who were elected by people, "are illegitimate and are standing in my way. I embody you, the will of the people." Now, in the reason why that's constitutional crisis is she was speaking as if she had some kind of independent mandate, almost like an executive president, which, you know, that's why you can imagine Donald Trump doing it in America. And it's the sort of speech French presidents sometimes make, you know, denouncing the assembly or whatever. But under our system, you're not meant to do that. You're not meant to say it would be the Prime Minister against the MPs. In fact, in our system, you are only Prime Minister because you have the support of MPs. And yet that, taken together with the way she has ignored these votes of Parliament, does make you now think, well, who actually is sovereign in our country? You know, the system is meant to be parliamentary sovereignty. Parliament keep voting for things and voting down things, and she just ignores them and pretends they haven't happened because she's the Prime Minister, as if she has this executive power. So I think that is actually where the constitutional crisis is located, because Parliament, for example, you know, clearly seems to not want her deal, doesn't really want no deal either, but has no idea how to wrench the steering wheel back from her, because under our normal system, by now, she'd have just given it up because she'd have seen that she didn't have a mandate in Parliament. So I think there is a real clash there and even a crisis.
Katie, as Johnny said, it's a bit of a weird strategy, isn't it? She's got to win MPs behind a deal next week, and she stands on a podium and basically says it's all their fault and gets their backs up. What do you think she was playing at?
I think the initial reaction in government after that speech was, what was that? In the sense that it just didn't seem to make too much sense. I think if you were going to be kind and try and rationalise that speech, there is a view...
Let's do that.
There is a view in number 10 that Theresa May is in touch with people in the sense that lots of the public want to just get on with Brexit. And their internal polling tells them that people want to get on with Brexit, and also were May to pass a Brexit deal, that would be welcomed, they think, and it would boost the Conservative Party. They believe that Labour have similar polling, which is why they don't want to get behind a Tory Brexit, because they know if May's deal passes, it only benefits the Tories. So I think what she was trying to do there was kind of set out her stall, and there's some talk that maybe if MPs refuse to play ball, this could be the beginning of a general election. Personally, I don't see how she calls one and gets it through, given that Tory MPs have to cooperate with that and they don't want a general election. There's also another point there, which is she thinking about her legacy? Is she thinking about how she is remembered in the history books? Because Theresa May sees herself as a public servant. She thinks that she is enacting the will of the people, to use that phrase. And I think there she was really trying to make that narrative, you know, that I'm working really hard, all these people around you are not doing the same. But on a purely tactical level, looking ahead to a vote in a couple of days' time, it's pretty disastrous. And Theresa May is trying to get Labour votes. And within about half an hour of that speech, we saw how it had backfired, because Lisa Nandy represents the Leave seat, has said she's been inundated with mail from constituents who want a no-deal Brexit. She doesn't want a no-deal Brexit. She does want to respect the result. She is the type of MP Theresa May needs to get on side if she is to get that deal over the line and replace some of the Eurosceptic votes in her party she's not going to get. But Lisa Nandy has said that she was offended by that speech and it will have lost her support. So it hasn't worked on that level and it hasn't worked within the Tory party.
So do you basically think it means that any chance of the deal going through are effectively gone now?
I think stranger things have happened in politics in the past 3 years. Even though it looks near impossible that Theresa May can pass her deal, it could somehow happen. But I would say...
And what's the route to that, do you think? Do you think it will be through Labour support or ERG support?
I think you need... What she needs is a domino effect. On Monday, it seemed that things were moving. You'd had talks with the DUP all weekend. Some Brexiteers were getting nervous. I think Theresa May's problem is we're recording on a Thursday and it's got worse for her. Actually, those talks have stopped. People have hardened. And what Theresa May needs to pass her deal is the DUP to come on side. Then lots of Tories who are very nervous about the idea that they would pass a deal which would lose them the support of their confidence and supply partner and therefore lead to a general election anyway. They would say, okay, well, if the DUP like it, I can put my doubts aside, I'll go for it. I left with 20 Eurosceptics probably who don't want it anyway because it's not perfect. But then you go to Labour votes, MPs and Leave seats, who that now go, well, you know what, I've just got to get over the line and I will get some heat, but I'm willing to do that to get Brexit through. They're not going to do that if it looks like they're just reducing Theresa May's defeat slightly. The problem is no one wants to be the first domino, and therefore it's very hard to see how she moves the dial between now and next week.
Ellie, Jeremy Corbyn's off to Brussels today. He's going to be meeting with Michel Barnier. What do you think his strategy is in all of this?
I think the Labour strategy is basically to try and come up with an alternative consensus. You know, we know that Jeremy has also met Nick Bowles, for example. He's met with other party leaders. And I think there is momentum in Parliament around a soft Brexit. I think that is the one thing that...
They haven't quite got the numbers yet, though, have they?
No, but they've got more numbers for that than anything else, I would say. So I think that his agenda is to lead a new alternative consensus towards a kind of a Brexit with a customs union and some other kind of bells and whistles that will mean that the Brexit deal will be able to meet the tests that Labour's put forward on things like workers' rights, environmental standards and so on. So I think that on the one strand, he's trying to build up allies in Parliament of people who don't want May's deal but don't want no deal but do want to respect the result, or Remainers who are kind of wavering because they're anxious about no deal. And on the other hand, he wants to go to Brussels and he wants to say to them, the Tories are chaos, Labour is a safe pair of hands, you know, with Labour you can negotiate, you can have talks. And this has been going on for sort of 2 years. So I think he's kind of positioning himself in Brussels for the possibility of a general election and here to kind of try and build up momentum against May. And
I think that's right. That's the role they're projecting, and they would like people to see. Jeremy Corbyn is the person who can be a national unifier, who can forge a consensus that everyone could get behind. He badly undermined that brand by walking out of talks. Not because Theresa May was just giving him the same old speech. If he'd done that, that could actually have played very well for him. He walked out the minute he saw Chukwuemeka.
And why do you think he did that, Johnny?
Well, it seems as if, you know, he can't countenance being in the same room as this terrible turncoat from Labour. But if you are, I think Ellie May's logic was just right, which is that it's about forging together a partnership, you know, a consensus, an alternative one to... If you can't even build bridges with a guy who was in your party until 5 minutes ago, that he is somehow persona non grata, you can't tolerate being in the same room as him. I don't see how you can be the guy that everyone turns to. And also underline this difference between you and Theresa May, that, you know, she is being this sort of dictatorial figure who's insisting on her own plan. I'm the one who can bring two people together. Well, not if you can't be in the same room as the independent group. That seems undermining of the brand. Let's just put it like that.
And Annie-Mae, what do you think about that? And in particular, it really feels like, you know, Labour's been sort of trying to ride two horses in recent weeks. On the one hand, official party policy is in favour of a referendum. On the other, you know, you've got Jeremy Corbyn holding talks on a soft Brexit. What's Labour's real position here?
It's not quite accurate to say that Labour is in favour of a referendum. Labour is in favour of a referendum as one option, and its preferred option is a general election. Yes, it's in favour of a referendum, but it's in favour of a referendum alongside a lot of other things. And in terms of what happened yesterday, I do think that Jeremy Corbyn was wrong to walk out of those talks. Not because it really matters, but because it's given, and this isn't directed at Johnny, but it's given the journalists who don't like him more material to kind of bash him with, when actually what we should be talking about is the fact that yesterday the entire output of Theresa May was just political theatre. It was sort of toying with the legislature. Legislature. When actually this is a very serious moment of, as Johnny said, constitutional crisis. And those talks yesterday with opposition party leaders, that was just a fugazi, because no one has changed position. She doesn't need to have a meeting with them to know what the compromise needs to be, what they want. They've set that out for the last 2 years. You know, even the independent group, which is extremely new, now has a position on Brexit. So she doesn't need a meeting to know that. The reason that she called that meeting was to get them all in the same room, so then later on she could go on TV and then act like she tried to reach across the house and had been shunned, so that she could then blame them for this catastrophe, when actually really the responsibility lies with her. And I think that's what we should be talking about.
That's completely right, which is why it would have been brilliant if he'd have walked out once she'd started talking and he'd realised she's not moving. That would have been a really clever intervention, because it would have said she's not serious about building cross-party consensus. But to walk out the earlier bit makes it seem as if that's not his problem with it. His problem with it is he doesn't want to be tainted by contact with Chukwuemeka.
I mean, he did have 20 minutes on the phone with her yesterday evening, which, I mean, is pretty admirable.
I want to spend a bit of time now talking about the other negotiating party in all of this, which it's easy to forget about when we're kind of heads down in UK constitutional crisis. And that's what the EU strategy here is. Katie, do you think that Donald Tusk thought he was helping Theresa May out by saying that she would only get a short extension only if she got her deal through?
Potentially. I don't think it's actually the worst thing to have happened to Theresa May this week, but then that's not really a high bar. In fairness, Donald Tusk was simply replying to her request. So lots of people have read it as, if her deal doesn't pass, we head to no deal. I don't think it's as clear cut as that. The Prime Minister's only asked for a short extension, and Donald Tusk has responded to that, saying there's only a point in a short extension if you have a deal and you're trying to get legislation through. I think that's fairly consistent with what Brussels have said about justification for extensions. And perhaps it was helpful of him not to say, which he didn't get into this, he didn't say, if she asks for a long extension, we'll give you a long extension. I think that would have been unhelpful to her. But I also think that there is a view in government that Brussels are willing to give a long extension if the deal does fall.
The trouble that is on its face was that it seemed to incentivise the ERG to vote down May's deal, because they were thinking, great, so if we vote this down, as Tusk said, we might, then he won't give a short extension, we'll leave on Friday. Brilliant. And
wherever you're coming from, really, you can look at
he's made no deal more attractive.
But I do think that is actually Theresa May's making, because it was Theresa May's decision to ask for a short extension, not a short and potentially a long one. Her original plan, when you look at the motion the government put down last week, which MPs voted on and thought they would probably get, was short extension if she passes her deal, and if not, she would seek a longer extension. And the reason that she ended up not asking for a long extension, even though she hadn't managed to hold the vote because of Berko's ruling, was because she was under severe pressure from within her party to not go near that. If she had written to Donald Tusk asking for a long extension, a year, 2 years, I think we were starting to hear that we would get cabinet resignations, you would potentially get Eurosceptics teaming with Jeremy Corbyn in a no confidence vote. So it was a domestic reason, I think. And I think for that reason, Brussels may still offer that long extension.
Well, certainly some Labour MPs seem to think a long extension is still on the table. So we had Liz Kendall saying last night that she thought a long extension may still be a possibility. What do you think, Ellie, that does to Theresa May's chances of getting the deal through?
I think that basically in all, as Katie was saying, from all possible angles, she's actually increased the chance of her deal being voted down again because she's alienated MPs by attempting to blame them. And in terms of a long extension, there are MPs who don't want to leave the EU who would favour a long extension. But also the ERG, she's been trying to use the threat of a long extension to scare the ERG into backing her deal. And I think the one thing that is very clear when you listen to what the ERG is saying is that they do not appreciate being blackmailed in that way. And I imagine that they would now vote her deal down as a way of saying you can't push us around like that. And I think, you know, I just want to make the general point that we've had 2 years now, which, you know, we triggered Article 50 2 years ago of these negotiations. And I think it's important to remember that at every possible important juncture, Theresa May has played politics with the country. She didn't need to trigger Article 50. She did that. She called a general election. She didn't need to do that. She did that. And it was all to sort of shore up Tory support within the country. She's really abusing the Parliament, I think. What she did yesterday was just total theatre, getting all the journalists in London to run off to Number 10 and then say nothing. You know, constantly bringing the same stuff back to Parliament only to be voted down over and over again. You know, it's all politics. And really, we also know that the one thing that could actually really help the situation is if she agreed to a customs union. That would be really helpful. She's not going to do that because it's going to split her party. So she's keeping her party together at the expense of the country. So I think it's really important to make the point that every time the national interest has collided with her own interests or her party's interests, she's always picked her own interests or her party's interests. And I don't think she's fit to be Prime Minister.
Johnny, I want to come to you and ask you what you think is going to happen next and whether you think the chances of a no-deal scenario come next Friday have actually gone up.
That's why I agree with what Ellie Major said about how that's the problem here, that nobody, you know, Theresa May never puts the national interest first, and that's partly why, or largely why, we're in this mess. The no-deal scenario terrifies me, and one particular form of it terrifies me, which is the notion of getting there by accident, is what I think of as the kind of 1914 scenario, where no one wanted it, but through a series of decisions, each person, as it were, rationally calculating their self-interest, they think that we get to this situation. And that's why I thought I was disappointed by Donald Tusk saying that, because I could see why he narrowly may have thought that was clever, but he made suddenly no deal loom larger, and there are people who want it, actively want it, and so he gave them another incentive. I just worry about the amount of time there is. I take Katie's earlier point about the dominoes and how that sequence, but there's not much time for them to all fall. You know, people talking about a European Council on next Thursday, that's the day before, in effect. So on the Friday, you would have to get Parliament would have to find the tool to either revoke Article 50 or to pass something else with hours to spare, the clock ticking down. And I just think, you know, that fateful decisions in history are made often by accident, by people who are exhausted and rushed. And also this assumption they have that something's going to come along or someone else is going to step in, someone else will fold. You know, this is a sort of three-way game of chicken a bit with Theresa May, the European Union and Parliament, and everyone thinks someone else is going to give way, and it's possible that nobody gives way. And I now look at avoiding no deal as actually quite difficult. It's not just threading a needle, it's threading a series of needles.
Yeah.
And a lot of things have to now go right in the space of a week for us not to crash out with no deal. And everyone says it's Armageddon and apocalypse, but who is actually going to wrest Theresa May's hands off that steering wheel? Who is going to give a little Brussels end in terms of extension? So I am gloomy about that.
That is very sobering, Johnny. Katie, you know, what's going to happen if the deal doesn't get through? Who would ask the EU for a long extension? Would that be Theresa May?
Well, the question is, would Theresa May try and steer the country to no deal if her deal is voted down again? And there are people over the past few days who feel that she is not ruling that out. They think they are getting implications, small signs that might be something she would consider. Now, I think lots of people just read into Brexit whatever they personally want to see. So if a Brexiteer MP speaks to Theresa May and says that, it doesn't necessarily mean it's the case. We've already heard from Theresa May that she, as a Prime Minister, could not countenance extending Article 50 past June. So I think there's a serious question if this deal is voted down and the EU say you can extend for a year or you can go to no deal, what she would do. But I do think that we have seen time and time again that, yes, the legal reality is we're heading to no deal if we don't agree a deal. But the political reality is there is a majority of MPs in the House of Commons completely opposed to no deal. And I think that were it to look like the Prime Minister was moving that way, I do think Parliament would take steps. And we've heard many times before about Parliament taking control. But I think when you get that close, people like Amber Rudd, people like David Gawke, cabinet ministers, I don't think Philip Hammond even, I don't think they would sit on their hands and let that happen. So I do think that the political will of Parliament would stop that.
That's only my hope. My worry is that Parliament has expressed its will and just been ignored. So if they vote to say we don't want no deal to happen, I can really see her stepping forward and saying there's my deal and the same speech again, because they don't have the actual executive instrument to stop it.
But we could see, so there is some talk, isn't there? There was a very narrow vote last time around Parliament taking control of the agenda, holding a series of indicative votes. There's an idea that that might happen again next Monday, and then if her deal gets lost on Tuesday, we might see Parliament cycling through indicative votes. So I suppose that there may be some means, Johnny, for Parliament to try and wrest control.
I did think all of those things. I now think the way she speaks about Parliament's votes as either as if they haven't happened or as if they're illegitimate makes you think, even if that happened, short of actually getting her out of the chair at number 10 and getting, you know, even David Lidington in there, somebody to sign that letter to the EU about Article 50, short of that, I don't know how you do it. I think she has to, for this to happen, she probably has to be removed. It's very striking that she said, I will not be Prime Minister for a long extension beyond June 30th. She hasn't said that about no deal.
And how do you...
She says, I will not be... She has never said the words, I cannot, as Prime Minister, take us over that cliff into no deal.
And how do you remove a Prime Minister in this position? Because, you know, we've already seen her party, they had a vote of no confidence in her. They can't challenge her again until December. I suppose there's a vote of no confidence in the government. Is that what would need to happen?
Well, I think that's why I was talking about constitutional crisis territory. I think we don't know how to deal with not just all the bizarre geometry of Brexit, but specifically a Prime Minister who seems to think she has some mandate separate from the House of Commons. And that's why that speech, which on one level was totally insignificant, she was just saying everything else again, that was true of the words, but the music of the speech was saying, I am this separate leader. And that is a new situation and one that I think does raise the questions of a constitutional crisis.
But I do think there are ways to remove a Prime Minister outside of you know, the traditional Tory way of having that vote, because she is safe, we know, until around December. But you could have a mass cabinet walkout. That's something that ministers have talked about in the past. And you can also have a situation where the chief whip speaks to the chair of the 1922 committee, Graham Brady, and they go and pay a visit to number 10 and say, you do need to step aside. Now, at the moment, or at least last week, the idea was they might decide to do this if her promising to resign would get her deal over the line, because some Brexiteers say they could vote for the deal if they knew she wouldn't be there for the second half of the negotiations. But again, if things next week start to really take on a new element and she starts to do things that the House of Commons and a lot of the Tory party are against, I do think there are ways that you can, even a very stubborn Prime Minister, make it very difficult for them to stay in post.
I completely could not agree more with Johnny. In fact, I don't know if it's unethical for me to admit this, but I actually, some months ago, put a bet on no deal. So I win 60 quid if it's no deal, but not because I think
That'll be enough to see you through Brexit catastrophe.
Yeah, I know. It's a shame that our currency will be meaningless. but it's not because I think it's an absolute certainty, but I've always thought it's a very real possibility. And I think World War One is the perfect analogy. You know, it was a time when everybody thought, well, that won't happen because that would be terrible. So it was, you know, a series of terrible miscalculations and hubris that led to people just sort of falling into it. And I think that is the scenario by which we have no deal. And what I would add to what Johnny said is that I think the only way that we can, or for me, the most likely way that that can be avoided, is if Theresa May spends the next week trying to get the numbers, get as many numbers as she can behind her deal. And then the reason for that is that if it looks like it's on a knife edge, you don't want to be the MP that made no deal happen. You know, you don't want to be the person that gets blamed for that. You don't want to be the one that, like, that Theresa May is saying, well, we could have had a deal, but now we have no deal and there's lorries backed up all the way to Dover because these four people decided to vote against it. So I think that is the way that she can get us out of this situation, or maybe that's what she's, I think that's what she should be trying to do now, is if she wants to get her deal through, is get the numbers up so that no one wants to feel that they are personally responsible.
So trying to recruit that first domino.
Exactly.
So to finish off, quick predictions for next Friday. What do you all think is going to happen? Ellie Mae?
No deal.
Johnny?
I'm definitely have given up making any predictions about anything, so I'm not going to. I fear the no deal scenario for the reasons I said. You know, in the end, I do hope that delay is the thing that all politicians always reach for, because they get to live to fight another day. So some kind of delay.
I think deal voted down, Tory civil war, Brexit delay.
Thanks all. We'll have to leave that there, but we'll be back after this. It's time to focus.
I think ultimately that ideology is fading, but it will have a sting in the tail, and we see that sometimes with these flare-ups and violence.
Today in Focus is the new daily podcast from The Guardian. Join me, Anushka Astana, for the best stories from our journalists around the world. Subscribe now to Today in Focus from The Guardian.
Welcome back. Now, 700,000 Remainers descended on London last October for the People's Vote March, in one of the biggest political protests of the last century. This Saturday, organisers are hoping even more will gather for the Put It to the People March on the eve of next week's Brexit deadline. 200 coaches are booked to transport protesters to London, more than double last time, some of them funded by celebrity Remainers such as Delia Smith, Patrick Stewart and Steve Coogan. Let's hope the weather's nice. Richard Brooks is co-founder of the For Our Future Sake and the People's Vote campaign, and joined me earlier. So Richard, it's the big march this Saturday. How many people are you expecting along?
Well, 162,000 people, as of about half an hour ago, have signed up to the march. That's already far more than the last one, which obviously had 700,000 people at it. We're expecting it to be hundreds of thousands of people. It's obviously hard to put a point on it, but I think the point really is that people who've never been engaged with politics before, people who are young in particular, who've never had the opportunity to be engaged with politics, have all said they're attending the Come to the March and they're excited for it. So we expect it to be a sight to see.
Are you hoping it's going to hit a million mark?
I obviously hope that. Whether or not it will, I don't know. To be honest, I'm just hoping that people see, not just in the United Kingdom, but obviously across Europe, the real like strength of feeling with the British public to support a people's vote. And I do think we'll hopefully achieve that on Saturday.
Theresa May's got a bit of a reputation of having a tin ear as Prime Minister. She's not really going to listen to all these people, is she? So what's the point of the march?
Well, I guess there's two things I'd say to that. One is that there's always kind of this narrative that marches don't change anything, that direct action doesn't change anything. My background's very much in kind of student unions and student politics, and our argument would always be that you need to have parliamentary strategies as well as kind of mass movements throughout the history of the United Kingdom, and I would suggest across the kind of developed world essentially, that you've got mass movements, be it on civil rights all the way through to tuition fees. Even if they're not kind of successful in the specific short term, they always have a incredible impact. And you're right, maybe Theresa May, who's entirely correct, is quite famous for having a tin ear, might not listen, but it's not entirely aimed at her. It's aimed at Parliament, who we want to, and parliamentarians, who we want to listen to the people, who want to put it back to the people.
When the People's Vote campaign kicked off, a referendum looked all but impossible, really. How optimistic are you feeling going into next week? Do you think that things have really changed for you guys?
Yeah, very much so. Before I did this job, I worked in the charity sector for a really nice youth charity. And when I said I was leaving that job, which was a very good one and quite a stable one, as well, comparatively to everything in politics right now, people quite openly laughed at me. And I sort of understood, you know, People's Vote was a bit of a fringe issue in spring last year. You know, we are exceedingly happy insofar in that every barrier that people thought that we wouldn't overcome, be it being able to put on a mass march, being able to gather together kind of hundreds of MPs or pass policy at Labour Party's conference, we've surpassed them. So in terms of the tone right now, you know, I think we have to be honest and say this is a moment of national crisis. I think kind of optimism feels like a too strong a word because of that. This is serious stuff. But you know, we're in the game. We're going to be, I believe, always the last person standing, because the reality is that no Brexit delivers on the promises of 2016. And therefore, I'm hopeful that we'll get to a point where Parliament takes the view, which I think they should, that Brexit has to be put back to the people, no matter what deal they agree on or not.
So last week, there was a people's vote amendment put before Parliament by the MP Sarah Wollaston, and yet the people's vote campaign asked MPs not to vote for it, to abstain on that vote. Why?
So again, I think this is a consequence of, and it feels counterintuitive, it's not how I've done political campaigning in the past, but I think it's definitely the right way forward, which is our last person standing strategy, which, you know, as I say, is not necessarily what we're used to in politics. But the reality was that last week wasn't the correct time, both in a practical sense in terms of numbers, but more of a principle point to support a people's vote, we think, because we think Parliament needs to be allowed to sketch out all of the other Brexit options in detail and frankly come to the conclusion that none of them match up to what they hope it would be. So it wasn't the right time then, but it will be at some point in the near future. And obviously, in particular...
And is that point next week? Because it's getting a bit close to the wire, isn't it? You talk about Parliament getting to vote on, have indicative votes on other options. I mean, the fact is that if nothing changes and May's deal doesn't go through, we're due to crash out of the EU in 8 days. So what's your strategy for next week?
Well, it very well may be. So I guess the strategy is clear from our perspective. One is obviously building momentum to the Put It to the People March, where we're hoping hundreds of thousands of people from across the United Kingdom, senior politicians, senior and interesting people, I would suggest celebrities from all walks of life, will take part. Obviously, at that point, I think that'll be a real show of force. And in particular, and I can't take credit for this in any way, but obviously the timing of the march, I think, couldn't actually have been better timed. So I'm hoping that that'll have a big impact. Going into next week, obviously, we'll have to see what happens at the council over the next, the European Council, should I say, over the next 24 hours. Depending on how that plays out, you know, if they offer a short extension to Article 50 on the proviso that Theresa May's deal passes, which I still strongly believe it won't, or a longer extension based on whatever kind of add-ons are put on there from the EU27, there will, I believe and hope, be more time for Parliament to come to a view as to what they believe a Brexit deal could look like. And then, you know, as we say, the reality is that we've always been a campaign focused entirely on democracy, which is that no matter what Parliament comes to a view, whether it's the Prime Minister's deal, Norway Plus, or whatever else someone's selling at any given time, that should be put back to the people, because ultimately they're the ones who need to take a view on something that's so important and frankly has changed so much now that we know so much more over the last 3 years.
And there is this amendment called the Kyle Wilson Amendment, which is a compromise amendment. It's MPs saying to Theresa May, we'll support your deal, we'll get it through Parliament, but only if you put it to voters for ratification in a referendum. Would you support that amendment being put to Parliament at the same time as Theresa May's deal next week?
Well, I mean, potentially, because I think that you're right, it's a good compromise amendment. It allows both Conservative and Labour MPs who are concerned about going back to their constituents and looking like, correctly or incorrectly, that they are blocking or delaying Brexit to say, no, hang on, I have voted for this deal. But as I say, also, I think fulfills a very strong democratic point, which is that so much has changed that we need to put this back to the people. So, yeah, I think it's something that obviously the People's Vote campaign are aware of. It's something that feels like a good compromise. And to be honest with you, of all of the options that are currently on the table, be it a kind of unsketched out Brexit plan or whatever Boris Johnson puts in a Daily Telegraph article on Monday versus kind of Theresa May's deal or even the Norway option, which has got a 13% approval rating, that all of those things, all of those options don't appear to satisfy either Parliament, Cabinet or the country. And therefore, that feels like the Kyle Wilson Amendment, that it would be a good compromise to move forward.
And what about the risks of a referendum? So lots of people are very worried that if we have another referendum, it's going to be incredibly divisive. It's going to reopen some of those very toxic debates. I mean, still toxic debates that we've been having over the last 2 or 3 years. What's the people's vote take on that?
Well, broadly, I'd say two things. One is that the country is already divided. And I think broadly that a people's vote may be the only way actually to bring the country together, because it will bring clarity. One of the real issues I think we've had over the last 3 years is there's been lots of people in Parliament, unfortunately, not all of them, but have been selling unicorns for the last 3 years. And when unicorns turn out not to be real, people are understandably upset. So I think a people's vote with two clear options on it will allow people to move forward onto the next bit. But the second thing, and I do feel really strongly about this, is the fact that I don't think there's anything more divisive than the undelivered promises of Brexit, because in places like Burnley or Huddersfield or Dover, where I'm from, people have really legitimate grievances about their lives. People are genuinely upset about stagnating wages or feeling a sense of lack of control or that decisions are taken about them without their input. And the reality is that we now know so clearly that not only is Brexit not going to make those things better, it's going to actively make those things worse. So I don't believe that delivering either the Prime Minister's or any other form of Brexit is going to heal those divisions. It's going to make them worse.
Richard Brooks there. So, Johnny, we saw 700,000 people march for another referendum last October, and there was absolutely no response at all from the government. There's some predictions that we might see 1 million people turn out on the streets this Saturday. Do you think it's going to have any impact at all?
I doubt it, because we've got used to shrugging off those expressions. And the, you know, people do know that 16 million people did vote to remain, so 1 million of them on the streets. A lot of people will say, well, we already knew that. That would be discounted. I think, though, it will embolden and sort of cheer up, in a way, those people who are doing it. I also agree with that prediction that it will be big and very spirited. But we've got into this nothing has changed era, where all, you know, things keep happening and our politicians don't react to them. You know, I interviewed David Owen this week, and he diagnosed, as a former doctor, Theresa May as suffering from cognitive inflexibility, which is an actual condition where new facts are presented to you and you don't adapt to that new information. And she's got that. But in some ways, I think our whole system has got that, where we don't sort of react to changing circumstances. So I think this big thing will happen. Just as there was this petition about revoking Article 50 that went online on Thursday morning and, you know, crashed under the weight. I don't know whether that, you know, even things that normally did used to move the dial, like rebellions in the House of Commons, don't at the moment. So I'm not sure a big demonstration that might cheer everyone up who goes on it. I'm not sure it will move things.
Ellie May, what do you reckon? Do you think Jeremy Corbyn's going to be on this march?
I don't think he will. And I think, I probably think it's for the best that he doesn't, because if the Labour strategy, which it is to argue for a general election, then going on a march that calls for a second referendum could confuse the picture. On the other hand, I was in the US for Trump's inauguration, and I went to the big women's march the next day. And what I felt happening in the US is that people view the Trump agenda as a very reactionary project. They're very frightened of it, and it's led to a backlash, which is not caused a consolidation of the centrist establishment, but has actually kind of reinvigorated the left. And I think outside of, you know, Parliament and all of the games that entails, where you have people in the People's Vote campaign criticising Corbyn and then the Labour leadership not really appreciating that, I actually think, I kind of wonder, in the general population, whether people have been kind of horrified by the Nigel Farage-esque reactionary tones of the Leave campaign, and it's led to a sort of progressive backlash. And if that's the case, I think that that is something that Labour should engage with. It shouldn't assume that everybody who is vehemently opposed to Brexit shares the same politics as Alistair Campbell, and that maybe it's an outrage and shock and upset at something that they view as very reactionary that's motivating them. And if that's the case, that is something that I think Labour should engage with. And in fact, I'm going to the march, not as a protester, but as a journalist, to try and understand the constituency of people who are actually coming out to march for this.
And Katie, do you think the chances of a referendum on May's deal have gone up as a result of this week? And do you think that there's any chance that we could see Article 50 actually being revoked?
So I think anything is possible when it comes to what happens next. I think a second referendum is probably a bit more likely than it was a few months ago. Jeremy Corbyn has reluctantly, or you could say half-heartedly, said it is in some way Labour policy, but it keeps changing in what sense. I think when it comes to actually getting a referendum through Parliament, the numbers currently aren't there. That's why time and time again we have seen these second referendum amendments appear, and then various groups who are apparently for a second referendum say they're not going to vote for it because now is not the time. What second referendum campaigners believe is that they don't actually need to prove they have the numbers right now. They just need to stay in the game. If you just keep that option on the table, eventually more MPs will come around as the only way to break the parliamentary logjam. So I still think it's possible. I think a general election is more likely. And it's interesting on whether we are going to revoke Article 50, because everyone's getting very excited about the fact there is a petition that has crashed the Parliament website because it's
popular.
So popular. I don't think it will be revoked, because I just think there'd be such a backlash. I think a second referendum would be tricky enough to land with even some people who voted Remain and most Leave voters, that the idea of just revoking Article 50, and you could say it's a time of crisis, we need to pause, but personally, I don't think this government at least would countenance that.
Okay, well, thanks everyone. That's all we've got time for this week. My thanks to all of our guests, Jonathan Friedland, Ellie May O'Hagan, Katie Balls and Richard Brooks. The producer was Simon Barnard. I'm Sonia Soda. Thanks for listening.
For more great podcasts from The Guardian, just go to theguardian.com/podcasts.